11. And looking very good there, thank you. All right. And let's just read verse 21, Daniel 11, 21. Now, we're not up to Daniel 11, 21 in our history yet, and in looking at this prophecy yet, but this is kind of where we're headed. So, Daniel 11, 21, and in his place shall arise a vile person, and we'll stop there, and that is talking about a person who will foreshadow the Antichrist, and that person is Antiochus Epiphanes. And so we're going to be tracing this history out, which was given as a vision to Daniel ahead of time, and we are going to move through and see the eventual rise of Antiochus Epiphanes. And he was, in the eyes of the Jews and in the eyes of many people, a vile person. And he brought more headache and heartache and persecution to Israel than anybody in his time. Epiphanes is supposed to be somewhat like a God manifest. Now, all of these rulers gave themselves these high-sounding names, but he went a step above them and said, well, he's Epiphanes, God manifest. And people would say that he's Antiochus Epimenes, which means madman, which was they people thought was more fitting. But anyway, so that's where we're headed. So let's see where we are in this vision. If you remember, we have conflicts between two kingdoms. There is the southern kingdom, which is Egypt. That would be here. And then the northern kingdom is the Syria Seleucid Empire up there. And basically, Daniel 11 involves lots and lots and lots of fights between these two lands. Who's in the middle of these two lands? Well, Jerusalem's right there, and Jerusalem gets caught in the crossfire a lot. So we looked last time, and we're not going to dwell on this very long, but some of the fights between north and south, and the interesting thing is that this is late enough in history. I mean, this is not, you know, going back to the early days of the Old Testament. This is not Abraham's time and things like that, where we have very little evidence other than, you know, pyramids of Egypt or something like that. This is late enough and in a culture whereby we actually have some pictures of what these people look like, whether they're on ancient coins or something like that. So that's kind of neat because we have something to go along. So anyway, there were lots of fights between these two lands, and sometimes there were alliances that tried to be made. For instance, down in the south, they gave a daughter in marriage to somebody of the north, and that's some of the scriptures that have to do with that, and that didn't work out too well. We read that, we went over that last time. Later, we have the land of Israel, or Jerusalem in particular, being taken over by Egypt. And for a while, this relationship was a little bit benign. Even though Egypt was in charge, Israel didn't really feel too much different. But in time, Ptolemy IV ends up persecuting the Jewish people. So everybody from the south is named Ptolemy. There are going to be several successive rulers, and they're all named Ptolemy, just a different number after them. So don't be afraid of that. If you're thinking the south, Egypt, just the ruler's name is Ptolemy. You just all need to figure out the number. Up in the north, the ruler's name could be Seleucus, or it could be Antiochus, and you'll cover almost all of them just with those two names. So anyway, and the scheme that we use, the purple writing up here, tells us who's in charge, who's ruling at the time of what's going on the current slide, and then there'll be some words describing what happened. So Ptolemy starts persecuting the Jewish people, and this led to a little bit of a rebellion of the people that we looked at, just mentioned last time, and Ptolemy IV deals with this unsuccessful Jewish rebellion. And this is a verse that kind of goes along with that. Many rising up against the king of the south, also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. And the idea there seems to be that there are people from the land of people from Jerusalem and surrounding areas that are fighting back against this persecution in hopes of bringing in promises like the promise of Messiah and promise of peace and things like that. So they're trying to fulfill it themselves, but they end up failing to do so. And Ptolemy deals with this unsuccessful rebellion. All right, we'll move ahead. And if you remember also, Antiochus III, this is not the really bad guy we're talking about later, Antiochus Epiphanes. This is not him. This is before him, Antiochus III, called Antiochus the Great. And he comes and takes over Jerusalem and pushes Egypt out of control of Jerusalem. And this had a very interesting effect on Jerusalem because a lot of people in Jerusalem saw that as a good thing. They welcomed Antiochus III kind of as a savior that they got them out of the hand of Egypt. Now, as time will go on, they're going to be longing for the days when they were under Egypt because the new ruler of the north will be so bad. All right, so then that happens. And then toward the end of the last time, we saw that there was the idea of Antiochus the Great up in the north. He said, well, I know how I'm going to subdue the people in the south. I'm going to give my daughter in marriage to Ptolemy the Fifth. And Ptolemy the Fifth was very young, probably about 14 years old. And his daughter, who was very sharp, very worldwise, and very political, was about 17. So he's going to give this wise and strong-minded 17-year-old in marriage to this probably weak-thinking 14-year-old because he's so young. And the idea is that she's going to guide him into submission and kind of following the wishes of Antiochus the Great. The plan did not work. Now, this marriage, by the way, is the marriage that is celebrated on the Rosetta Stone, which was an amazing archaeological discovery, written in three languages, one of them being hieroglyphics. So the Rosetta Stone unlocked to researchers how to read hieroglyphics, because this was all in the same language, 1, 2, 3. So if you know the other two languages, which they knew, they could see the what hieroglyphics meant, and by that they could decode how to read hieroglyphics. So this was a peace treaty based on the marriage. Now, this did not work out so well because what happened was the daughter named Cleopatra, who is a predecessor a few generations back to the famous Cleopatra, this Cleopatra, who was 17, was so politically astute that she realized that aligning herself with the northern kingdom was not the best plan for safety. She realized that the tide was turning on the global scale toward Rome. Rome was the up-and-coming power. Rome was the one you wanted to align yourself with. So she guides Ptolemy V into aligning himself with Rome and coming under Rome's protection. That's going to be very important as we move along. So Antiochus didn't really like this, that his daughter had a mind of her own, and so he decided, well, he didn't really want to take it out on her, so he decided, why don't he go teach the Romans a lesson? Now, we all here, knowing, you know, 500 or 1,000 years of history of Rome, know that this is not a good idea. But he didn't have this history, so he figured, well, he's going to show her wrong and show that Rome really isn't that powerful. So he decides to go and start attacking over in Rome. Now, he doesn't make it all the way to Rome because Rome has now encroached as far as Greece, so he actually only makes it to Greece before he has to start fighting the Romans. And it's not long before he finally realizes his daughter was right. You don't mess with Rome. And in 188 BC, he's finally defeated and humiliated by Rome. Now, this kind of is following Daniel 11:18. After this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end, and with a reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So what happened after this is the surrender in 188 BC was called the Peace of Apamea, and this peace or treaty or whatever you call it, this surrender terms, included very onerous terms on Antiochus. That is, he had to pay reparations for the damage he caused by trying to go to war with them. So he has to go back to his own land, kind of in line with what this verse is saying. He has to go back to his own land looking for money to loot from anywhere he can to try to pay back these reparations. And he ends up in a temple in Susa trying to grab some money from them to pay these reparations and ends up being murdered there when he's trying to rob the temple. So a lot of these things, when Daniel gave them in this vision, could be read and seen kind of vaguely, but it's not until you live through the history that you look back and you say, oh, yeah, this really does match what's being said. All right, Daniel 11:20 then, there shall arise in his place, that is, he's just been assassinated at that temple, there shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. So here are the rulers at this point. Seleucus IV has now taken over from Antiochus the Great. So there's some image of him. All right, so what he does is he now also needs to get money. He also has this problem of reparations that are due. So he goes around looking for money just as his predecessor Antiochus III did. And he hears that there's a lot of money in the temple in Jerusalem. Whether this is true or not is another matter, but he thinks it's true. So he sends a guy named Heliodorus to raid the Jewish temple to pay war debts. His arrival in Jerusalem was very interesting, and it's documented that there was a feverish reaction from not only the people in the temple, but also the people just in the populace of Jerusalem. Women were in sackcloth and in the streets weeping. I mean, there was this huge, not rebellion in a fighting kind of way, but there was this huge among the populace expression of sadness as to what's happening. And he gets to the temple, Heliodorus does, with some manner of military with him. And in the temple, he's met with a vigorous response and resistance to his trying to come in and raid the Jewish temple. Now, whatever happens there, he ends up turning back. He does not raid the temple. And you ask, well, what exactly happened? Well, we're not sure, but what he says when he gets back to Seleucus is, he said, there were angels protecting the place. I tried to get in there, and, angel on a horse, a couple of other angels, angelic beings, you just can't approach the place. We don't know if Seleucus believed it or not, but Heliodorus didn't give him much time to think about it, because Heliodorus soon after assassinates Seleucus, so he didn't have to have his story go too far. This is a painting in the a Renaissance painting by a painter named Raphael called the Expulsion of Heliodorus from the Temple, and the idea is there's the prayers being made and here are supposedly these angelic beings and so on. Whatever resistance he found, he comes back with the story of these angels. So Heliodorus assassinates Seleucus, so he's no more. And at the same time, in Jerusalem, Jerusalem is starting to get fractured into two groups. One is called the Tobiads, and the other is Oniads. Now, the guy who was high priest at the time of this raid was a guy named Onias III, and he was a direct descendant of Aaron. He was the high priest, just like the high priest was designed to be in the scriptures, and a direct descendant of Aaron and high priest, but he was also very committed to the Hebrew scriptures and to the God of Israel. So he was kind of your conservative voice. At the same time, there were lots of people in Jerusalem that were favoring these new changes coming in by the Greeks, the Hellenization, if you will. So you have the liberals and the conservatives, basically. And this is going to turn out to be a rather big division in Jerusalem. And you might think of the Oniads as the pre-Pharisees and the Tobiads as the pre-Sadducees. But anyway, that's what's going on. So then we come to Daniel 11:21, where the verse that we read at the beginning talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. So Seleucus, the whatever he was, the fourth, has been assassinated, and now dear old Antiochus Epiphanes, not dear old, the crazy man, he, it says, will arise, he's a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. Now, the way he actually got power after Seleucus died, he was not the next one in line. His brother was the next one in line, and his brother was in prison at the moment. So he came along and he told the people, he's like, oh, no, no, it's my brother. He's the guy in charge, not me. But for the meantime, while he's, you know, indisposed, I'll just be a caretaker. Don't mind me. I'm just here to see to matters just while he's in prison. He's the real leader. Well, this gets him in peaceably, and nobody really raises a fuss because of the posture that he's taking. And he comes in with this posture until, of course, he starts gathering support. And that's the next verse. With the force of a... wait a minute. No, not the next verse. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. So he's going to gather around him a small group of loyal followers and then start to bribe, as needed, other leading figures in the empire to where before long he takes off the mask and says, no, forget my brother, I'm the guy in charge. Now, if we go back to the verse we skipped, this seems to be a verse that kind of characterizes his whole reign, not the next chronological event. So, with the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. Now, the idea is that any resistance to his rule was easily swept away. So, in other words, whenever there was a resistance to his rule, they will be swept away from before him. And the prince of the covenant probably is talking about Onias III, who we'll see very soon ends up being killed. All right, so once he had a small group of close supporters committed to him, he revealed himself as the ruler, not just the caretaker, and gained control with this small military force, as the verse is implying. All right. He shall enter peaceably even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. So he is the a ruler that now arises without this debt problem. the previous two rulers had these reparations to be paid, and he now has the luxury of not having that around his neck. So now he's able to squander much of Syria's wealth and buy loyalty from Syria's nobles with it. And he does whatever any other person in this paired relationship will do. He tries to attack the other people. I mean, this is all they can think of to do is just attack each other. But anyway, so he makes plans to launch a campaign against Ptolemy VI down in Egypt. Interesting things are happening in Jerusalem now. I told you that there's this split into conservatives and liberals. Well, there's a guy named Jason. His actual name was Joshua, but Joshua wasn't Greek, right? Joshua is not Greek enough, and he's got to be cool and Greek. So he changes his name to Jason, and he thinks to himself, he's actually the brother of Onias, the guy who's the real high priest. And he thinks to himself, you know, this Antiochus, I bet I can speak his language. He goes to have a meeting with Antiochus and says, listen, Onias, he's too conservative. He's an old stick in the mud. He's, what you want, Antiochus, is you want to make Jerusalem a showcase of Greek culture and Hellenization. You want to show it as a trophy, if you will, of what Greek influence can do. And I'm the guy that can do that for you, not Onias. What if you put me into the position of high priest, I'll make Jerusalem Greek for you, and I'll see to it that the revenue that you get from Jerusalem is more than it was before. Antiochus thinks about this, says, sounds good to me. So Onias is out, and Jason is now installed as new high priest by order of Antiochus. And Jason makes good on what he said he was going to do. He makes good on this. This is a Greek gymnasium, not the one that was built next to the temple in Jerusalem, but one similar to it. Anyway, he builds a Greek gymnasium right next to the temple. Now, when the games are performed in the ancient Greek gymnasiums, they are performed in gymnos, which means naked. In other words, all these pagan things that would come along with Greek culture are now not just in Jerusalem, but a stone's throw from the temple. And this is all what Jason is doing in becoming high priest. So he was brother of Onias, but they didn't get along at all. And Jason now brings in all of these awful things. So he transforms Jerusalem into a Hellenistic city. And then a guy named Menelaus comes along, and Menelaus sees what Jason did. Now, Menelaus is not even part of the family. See, Jason was Onias' brother. So Jason was a descendant of Aaron as well. Menelaus is not at all, but he thinks, well, what is this going to matter to Antiochus? So he goes to Antiochus and he said, listen, I can do one better than Jason. I can make Jerusalem more Greek, and I can give you even more revenue if you install me as high priest. So Antiochus thinks about that for a little bit, says, sounds good to me. So now Jason is out and Menelaus is appointed as high priest. I put exclamation points here because this is a very pivotal role in the history of Israel and Jerusalem. It's very pivotal because Menelaus is not a descendant of Aaron. This is the time in Israel's history when the office of the high priest stops being the religious institution that was prescribed in the Old Testament and becomes a political position. And now Menelaus, he's not even part of the family. It's now just a political position to get hold of. And because there was no king in Israel at this time, it was the most authoritative position in the land is to be the high priest. So that's a very important thing. So when the Lord came, and at his arrest and trial, you read about Caiaphas and Annas and names like that. These are a political position of high priest, not a scriptural position of high priest. Onias has had it, by the way, at this point. Onias stood by when Jason was high priest, because at least he was of the high priestly family. But when Menelaus gets appointed as high priest, that's it. Onias finally has to publicly object, and as you could imagine, his reward for that was being executed by order of Antiochus. So what this does is it makes the Onaiads, these people that are the conservatives, appeal to Ptolemy for help. You remember when they didn't want the Egyptians over them, and they were so happy when the Syrian, the Seleucid Empire took them over? Well, now they're rethinking that. They're saying, wait a minute. The conservatives go down to Egypt and say, they say, hey, we need help. We're getting destroyed here. And believe it or not, Ptolemy actually takes their request seriously and decides he's going to do something for them. So he ventures into the southern area. He's going to make a little staging area for plans for a bigger offensive later. Now, his initial action is not supposed to rile up anybody. It's kind of a small-scale kind of set staging area for doing something, but it turns out that it's met with a very strong military response from Antiochus Epiphanes. So even though Ptolemy had a larger army, Ptolemy was actually betrayed into Syrian hands by some of his closest advisors. So you see this in the verse, the king of the south shall be stirred to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against them, against him. Now, who is it that's devising the plans? Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. So he's actually betrayed by some of his closest people, and he ends up having to submit to Antiochus. So Ptolemy's army surrenders, and Ptolemy actually gets to live, but he's kind of reduced to a puppet leader taking orders from Antiochus. This all went according to plan, except in the city of Alexandria. In the city of Alexandria, they didn't want the puppet regime, and they appointed Ptolemy the VIII as their leader. Now, we're going from Ptolemy VI to Ptolemy VIII, because Ptolemy VI has a little infant son. That's Ptolemy VII, but he's just a little child, so he doesn't play into the game here. So Ptolemy VI is the puppet governor over Egypt. Ptolemy the VIII is the ruler over just Alexandria, and he is called Physcon, which means the fat. There's his picture. You can understand. Okay. All right, Daniel 11:27. Both these kings' hearts. Now, this is going to be Ptolemy and Antiochus. We're not talking about Physcon now. These two shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. But it not, shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. In other words, they get together, Antiochus and Ptolemy, to meet together to talk about how they're going to get rid of Physcon. But while they're talking, they're each plotting against each other. So it's a good old lying, hypocritical meeting, just like politicians have today. This is not the most eye-opening prophecy. I think I could prophesy this one from now and say, soon there will be a meeting of two political leaders, and they will speak well with each other, but deep down inside they will have plans against each other. I think that happens quite often. Anyway, that's what happened here. And so while returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. So Antiochus goes through Jerusalem on his way back after they've met together at this table for their lying, hypocritical meeting. He goes back through Jerusalem, and he needs money because he's staging an upcoming war again down south. So he leverages his buddy Menelaus, who he put into the high priest position, and imposes more taxes on the Jewish people. But while he's gone, this guy Physcon drives out Ptolemy VI. So the fat guy is now in charge of all of all of Egypt. This all leads to a very important conclusion, and that is Ptolemy VI, this guy that's now been turned into a puppet and then ousted by Physcon, he decides to appeal to Rome. Do you remember earlier Cleopatra guided Ptolemy V or whoever it was to court favor with Rome, which he did. And they formed an alliance like NATO, meaning that if you attack Egypt, it's like you're attacking Rome. And they have made this alliance. So Ptolemy VI, who's just been bumped out, goes to Rome and appeals for their help. And this is going to be a very big turning point in the history because Rome is going to listen and they're going to come in. And next time we're going to see that Antiochus Epiphanes is going to have to deal with Rome. It's not going to be pretty. He's going to chicken out, get embarrassed, and take all of his wrath out on Jerusalem. So that'll be for next time.